Senate Committee on Business, Transportation, and Workforce Development. The time of the meeting will be scheduled for 1 p.m. on May 21st, 2007 in Hearing Room B. Chair is Senator Rick Metzger.
Senate Committee on Business, Transportation, and Workforce Development for Monday the 21st. A couple of things. Work session on 2117 regarding the name change for people performing businesses, performing landscaping services. We have the agreement that was worked out plus the conflict amendment we just received. We're having copies made of that. We will come back to that when we have the copies in hand. House Bill 2538, a continuing ad for landscape contractors, will not be heard today. So let's begin by opening a work session on House Bill 2456A. Colleagues, 2456A is the bill that says the remaining 12 pre-1977 buses need to be put out of service by August of 2008. We heard that bill earlier. There is no proposed change to the language in that bill. You talked to Senator Nelson. Is it Janet? Is that correct? No, I guess that was Mr. Green who probably did.
Was that Mr. Green here?
Since the meeting, or?
Yeah, since the meeting.
No.
Well, it's not critical. Anyway, the point was that Senator Nelson was supportive of it. This, of course, is his district. So I just told him it might be helpful he'd be in here that day to tell us that. But in any case, we are short two members today. I had a talk with Senator George today, and I appreciate his willingness to help us move this to the floor so we can get through our schedule. So, Senator Monis Anderson, I would entertain a motion on 2456.
Mr. Chair, I move 2456 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Okay, Senator Monis Anderson has moved House Bill 2456A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion, Senator George?
I just basically wanted to make sure that we talk to the folks in the district. I'm reluctant to vote for these kind of mandates on school districts. I figure they can do them themselves, but if we need a vote to get it to the floor, then I'll do that, and I'll probably still support on the floor, but reluctantly.
Okay. Thank you, Senator. So I appreciate Senator George's willingness for us to move this bill on the floor. Is there any other objections? Not so ordered. Please mark Senator Starr and Senator Deckard as excused, and I will carry the bill on the floor. Okay, let's go to a public hearing. Are you ready for our first one?
Mm-hmm.
Our public hearing on House Bill 3485. Janet? And as we get the witness sheet, Janet will tell us what it's about.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 3485, and you should have the A engrossed bill, is at the request of the Portland Community Land Trust and Representative Dingfelder, and the bill would authorize the creation of affordable housing covenants that could restrict the price, rental rate, or occupancy. The covenants would be entered into on a voluntary basis by the property owner in exchange for benefits of a subsidy that may be present. Covenants are designed to help ensure adequate supplies of rental and owner-occupied affordable housing. There are currently such covenants, but having statutory authority to back them up would make sure that those may not be get into trouble in court if they're challenged. Mr. Chair, there's a 47-12 House vote, and there's no fiscal or revenue impact.
Okay. Allison Handler and Tad Everhart, please.
Senator Metzger, members of the committee, Allison Handler accompanied me from Portland. We drove straight to this meeting, and she was actually very hungry and dashed down to the cafeteria. Could this be brought up a few minutes later? Would that work? If not...
Are you Ted?
I am, sir.
Can you testify while we're waiting for her to devour her lunch?
Yes.
Okay, please do.
Thank you, Senator Metzger, members of the committee. My name is Tad Everhart. I'm a lawyer with the Community Development Law Center, which is a project of Legal Aid Services of Oregon,
located at 921 Southwest Washington in Portland. We represent organizations, nonprofit organizations, that develop and maintain affordable housing throughout the state of Oregon. Portland Community Land Trust came to us asking us to do legal research about the long-term validity and enforceability of affordable housing covenants. These are the type of covenants that typically you'll see on affordable housing projects, where we restrict the housing to people with low incomes. In the case of home ownership programs, we'll restrict the homes to be purchased by families with low incomes or moderate incomes. We'll also restrict the sale price at which they can subsequently resell the house to ensure that those houses remain affordable to people, ideally in perpetuity. We were unable to tell Portland Community Land Trust that courts would always enforce those long-term controls on real property because, in fact, common law is hostile to long-term restrictions on the use of real property. And that comes from basically English common law. And so we searched for ways that we might be able to serve the grantors who insist on long-term affordability in projects that they fund, but also make sure that those restrictions that we place on our projects would be enforceable for the long term. And we found that four states and other parts of the country have statutes that allow people that own an interest in real property to voluntarily restrict their property to certain uses, to certain occupancy of low income or moderate income people. And so what we did is we modeled this proposed statute on those four statutes, as well as other similar statutes that already exist in Oregon Revised Statutes. In particular, ORS Chapter 271 has authorized restrictions that have to do with conservation and other preservation easements. And so this bill represents basically a way to ensure that the restrictions that we place on property to ensure that they're used and enjoyed by low-income Oregonians will stay in place and will be enforceable for long term. And this is really important because nowadays to subsidize affordable housing, oftentimes you're talking of a subsidy of $10,000 to $20,000 to $50,000 or $60,000 per home or rental unit. This is Allison Hamlet.
I figured. Go ahead and continue.
And so I think just the background of this, of course, is that we're all familiar with CC&R's conditions, covenants, and restrictions that we typically see in a residential subdivision. This will basically be a law that will mean that affordable housing restrictions are enforceable for the long term. What it doesn't do is it does not require anyone to use the statute. And in fact, the only people that can use the statute are people that own an interest in real property and voluntarily choose to restrict that property. And there must be a subsidy, in other words, something in exchange for that restriction. So the bill is designed to be narrow in focus, with very clear rules on when it can be used and when it cannot be used. And typically the organization that you'd see using this would be not only community land trusts, but community action agencies, Habitats for Humanity, St. Vincent de Paul, other Oregon nonprofit organizations that build, develop, and maintain affordable housing. And so I'd be happy to entertain questions about the way the bill came about, and thank you for your time and attention.
Okay, thank you. So, as I looked at the material stuff, and what you just said is that this would be you would have a real estate holder who, in exchange for the subsidy that they would voluntarily accept, that they would then agree to whatever the covenants are restricting. In such a manner as to make it affordable for the individuals to be occupying it, and then they would weigh the subsidy versus the restriction and make a voluntary decision. Is that essentially the sum of it?
Perfect.
Okay. Well, let's go to our next testimony.
Thank you. Appreciate the time to testify before you. I'm Allison Handler. I work for the Portland Community Land Trust as executive director. I'll keep this very short. This bill is really important to the organizations across the state that already use affordability covenants in order to further our missions of providing affordable homes. I want to talk really briefly about community land trusts. That's specific to what I do. We're a really unique tool for home ownership. We make homes affordable typically by taking the land costs out of the equation. In a typical arrangement, we hold the land in trust, and we enter into a long-term lease agreement with the homeowner. This enables us to sell the house to the homeowner for a very, very reduced price, well below market. And our land lease is a 99-year lease that's renewable and inheritable, and that it contains a resale provision that enables the house to be resold to the next family, also a lower-income family, at a price that's also reduced. So families gain stability, equity, a legacy for their heirs. Our communities gain homes that are affordable in perpetuity. A couple of quick numbers to just share with you. The average price in Portland for a home today is $318,000. By contrast, we're selling houses for $125,000, so a very reduced price. Our funders are now routinely investing as much as $70,000 in cash, and often more in land value, to make the homes that we sell affordable to the families that we're serving. And our funders include both public and private sources. They legitimately want to know that their funds are protected, and that they're protected for a long time, and we've pledged to do that. The problem is, and this is why we're here today, to date we have used a CLT ground lease, a community land trust ground lease, to protect that affordability. We typically, as I said earlier, hold the land in trust and lease it. The problem is, CLTs across Oregon, and there's about a half dozen of us right now, are turning to high-density development, including condominiums, in order to stretch our limited dollars. And unfortunately, ground leasing is really, really unwieldy. Frankly, it's almost impossible in those sorts of situations, especially in mixed-income condos. We'll own no land at all, and yet we still want to make sure that some of the units in those developments remain affordable. So we can't use a land lease. We're going to use instead an affordability covenant. And it contains the same restrictions on resale to keep the units affordable. And affordability covenants, as Tad shared earlier, are very commonly used across the state. They're used by nonprofit organizations and by local government entities that provide favorable financing. But currently, there's no enabling overarching state statute that legitimizes this tool. And so our concern is we've pledged to our funders we will protect their investment of $70,000 in perpetuity, and yet, should these affordability covenants be challenged in court, there is that chance, however small, that they could be turned over. And so we're asking you to fix that problem for us and provide the enabling legislation that protects those covenants and ensures our ability to ensure that families 50 years from now, 100 years from now, have the same shot at home ownership that we're offering today. Thank you so much.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Handler. Questions? Senator George.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. How is it that when I'm a buyer in the market and I'm looking for a house, that I would know that these covenants are on the property? I mean, what's, besides just listing the CC&Rs, is there a disclosure that travels with the property, and can you explain it to me?
Yes. For our program, we do extensive home buyer education. We actually hand the buyer the document and say, this is the document that's going to be restricting your owner occupancy, your resale price. Take this to an attorney and walk it through with them and make sure that you're entering into this deal under your own steam, having been duly advised by someone who's not me. So it's really important to us that buyers really feel educated as to the trade-off, and it's a completely voluntary trade-off.
Mr. Chair, follow up. Is there subsequent buyers of that home? This is such an odd restriction or covenant on the property. Most people in the West especially wouldn't be used to these kind of covenants. How is it that we educate somebody 5, 10, 15, 20 years down the road that property has a permanent covenant on it?
Mm-hmm. I'll answer that question. We do extensive buyer education with every buyer who purchases a property through our program. And we actually actively manage the resale process. So we're helping broker that deal between the current owner, who was educated when they bought their house, and the new buyer So from now owner to seller to new buyer, we do all of that education, all of that brokering, and the next buyer also takes our documents to their attorney and reviews them. So it's an ongoing process of education and support on both sides. Does that answer your question?
And specifically, these covenants run with the land, and they would be subject to a title search. So they would come up just as easements, rights of way, access easements, any other impediment to clear title. They would be disclosed, just as if you buy a home in a subdivision, you'll see that there's an exception on the title report for the CC&Rs. This will come up, and then the title company will go through the records and find it. It's a requirement of the Affordable Housing Covenant created under statute that it be recorded.
Mr. Chair, so in essence what's happening is that your nonprofit organizations are holding an interest in the property. So if at some point in the future there was a decision made that we no longer wanted that housing unit as affordable housing, in essence what could be happening is the house could be sold at full market value, the owner would get the value of the home at the decreased value, and then you folks would get the value of the increased right that was existing.
And release the covenant.
Right.
And I can speak to that. We actually had that exact situation last year. We had a property in our portfolio that no longer met the needs of our families. We made a decision to sell and to reinvest the proceeds of sale in additional properties that would fit the needs of our families, and we released the restriction.
The bill has a specific provision so that if a restriction is terminated before the expected termination as provided in the covenant, then the difference between the restricted value and the market value does not go to the owner of the property, it goes to the covenant holder. The reason for that is to reduce the incentive for people to litigate these and to fight them to get them off the title of the property, because they will not financially benefit from that. The entity that put the subsidy into the property will get that difference in value.
I wish Senator Brzezinski was here.
Sorry. Any other questions? Okay. These are only two people who have testified on this bill. Any concerns in the committee on the bill? Okay. Then we will close the public hearing and open a work session on House Bill 3485.
Mr. Chair.
Yes? Would you like to come in late and testify? Okay, you may be dismissed. We are in work session, but I'll allow Mr. Martinez to come and make a comment or two.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Tim Martinez on behalf of the Oregon Bankers Association. I do appreciate it. I do apologize for coming in late. Oregon Bankers has no opposition to this bill, but we believe a word was dropped in the amendments that is fairly important. And if you're looking at the A engrossed, it would be on page 3 in line 6. This language talks about how a covenant can be terminated or modified. And in the original bill in 3485, this language said the covenant is modified or terminated by agreement of the eligible covenant holder. And in the engrossed bill in the amendments, the term or modified was dropped, or terminated was dropped, and we believe that's critical that be in there to make sure that the termination piece continues on consistently through the language, because it does talk about termination above in 4 in that same section. It talks about may not modify, terminate, or commence an action, and we're very concerned that that language repeat itself throughout the bill. So I do apologize for that. We caught it late. Okay, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
You want to come up here? Let's see if we have a confusion here or not. One of you.
Frankly, I didn't follow the discussion. So
Foley, let's see what you got. Mr. Chairman, if I may, if you look at
line six,
the original
page three.
Bill, if you talk up here, it talks about in line 24, and the original may be conveyed, assigned, modified, or terminated. And then down here, it talks about may be modified or terminated. And then it also later on talks about termination. But when you went to the A engrossed version, you talk about termination again in the same language, but then you no longer have modified or terminated, just have modified, and we believe that you really need both of those.
I tell you what we're going to do.
Yeah.
Because we can't do this in committee. I'm going to close the work session for the moment on 3485. If you folks want to go outside and see if you can clarify whether we have an issue or not, we will bring the bill back later in the afternoon. Otherwise, we'll move on.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
Okay. We have the amendments with us on 2117 now.
Yes.
Okay, let's reopen the work session on House Bill 2117. Janet.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2117 was heard last week, and the conflict in the bill was over the name landscape professional instead of landscape contractor, that change in name. And after the meeting, the people who were opposed, and you still have some letters at your place today from letters we received after the meeting that were opposed to the language of landscape professional, agreed to the term landscape construction professional. And so that is what is used in the amendments, the -2 amendments. And, Mr. Chair, there are also the amendments so long was that there are conflicts to resolve because those terms are used in other bills that are further along than this bill. So the conflicts are with House Bill 3354, 2075, 2076, and Senate Bill 62, and the amendments do take care of those conflicts.
So okay. The -2s have both the...
So basically it's the new bill. The -2 is the new bill.
The
and
new bill with all those changes.
Mr. Chair, I got them at the same time you did. Mike Snyder with the Landscape Contractors Board is here, and the -1 changes are included in the -2s is what he's confirming.
Okay, so essentially we're changing the name. We have a letter from Amy Willis who testified in opposition a couple of weeks ago agreeing to the this new language. So it seems like our designers and our landscapers now are happy. I'm happy if they're
Mr.
happy.
Chair, I move the -2 amendments to House Bill 2117.
Okay, Senator Moss Anderson has moved the -2 amendment to House Bill 2117. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2117 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Moss Anderson has moved House Bill 2117 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Objection? Ordered. Please mark Senator Decker, Senator Starr, excuse. Senator Moss Anderson, would you carry that bill?
Okay.
Okay, now let's get back on track here. We'll pick up a public hearing on House Bill 2498. Janet.
Mr. Chair, House Bill 2498 is at the request of the Oregon Association of Realtors, and you should have the A engrossed bill, and you should have A4 amendments. And those amendments the amendments clarify that the exemption does not apply to the construction of new homes. The bill extends a construction contractor licensing exemption to an owner in the business of reselling a structure if the owner hires a licensed contractor to do to do remodeling and construction work on the home. This is an exemption, among others, from having to have a construction contractor's board license, and it applies to having up to four homes. It's currently you would only be exempt if you lived in the home and hired a contractor and did the work to do the work. This would apply if you just own the home and hire a contractor, and applies up to four homes.
Okay, thank you, Janet. We have two people signed up, one in support, one in opposition, Harlan Levy and Eric Mahaffey. So if the two of you want to come forward. We'll start with Mr. Levy. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I am Harlan Levy, here representing the Oregon Association of Realtors, here to support House Bill 2498A, as well as the amendment that you have before you, the -A4 amendment. This bill deals with people who buy existing homes, hire licensed contractors to fix those homes up, and then put them back onto the market. These individuals are providing substantial benefit to consumers of residential housing by using their capital to improve the quality of existing homes. They add curb appeal to the existing homes in the neighborhood, and in many cases improve the property values of all those homes in the neighborhood. The problem that we have is current state law, or as 701.005 sub 3 defines the term contractor to include these people. According to statute, anybody who, quote, arranges for work to be done on an existing home is considered by statute to be a contractor and is required to be licensed by the CCB. This can be problematic for many folks, and many individuals, in fact, do not know that this is the status of the current law, and they may be arranging for work to be done without a license. There are current exemptions from licensure under current law, and those exemptions are listed in 701.010. Looking at the statute here, right now there are 15 separate exemptions listed, including the one for an owner of a house. The problem with the current exemption, the reason it does not apply to this circumstance, is that exemption requires that the person actually live in the house. So obviously, if you're the homeowner living in the house, you can arrange for work to be done by licensed contractors and not need to be licensed yourself. This bill would create a new exemption that would apply for owners who aren't living in the house, as long as they limit it to only four houses per year, and as long as, again, they are using only licensed contractors to do the work. The -A4 amendments, as the committee administrator said, will clarify that this new exemption only applies for existing structures. We're not talking about anybody that's out there building new homes. That had never been our intent, and we want to make sure that this bill would not allow for that. So I'm putting that on the record here, and I hope that should this committee move to the floor, that we can put some legislative history into the record as well. This bill only applies to existing homes. And I also want to stress that under this bill, all the work still must be done by licensed contractors. The work, and in addition to that, if the work is going to require a permit, then a general contractor has got to be used to obtain the permit. So we are providing significant protections for the consumer within this bill. In addition to that, if the work was done improperly, and the house were to be sold to a consumer, that would be a physical condition of the property which would be required to be disclosed by the seller. So if it did not get disclosed by the seller to the buyer, the buyer would have a cause of action against the seller for misrepresentation and potentially fraud. Excuse me. So this bill will work in favor of increasing the supply of rehabilitated and renovated houses, which should hopefully lead to their being generally more affordable for the public looking to buy a home. It would greatly assist many of those who are spending their available funds for a down payment and closing costs and who have no dollars left for fix-up or renovation purposes themselves. What we have in Oregon is an entry barrier. The existing licensing requirement creates that barrier and doesn't allow for people that want to engage in this practice, and that separates Oregon from most other states. We believe that this amounts to overregulation, which is not good for the real estate market, and we would hope that this committee and ultimately the Senate as a whole would agree. I do want to note that this bill passed the House of Representatives unanimously with a 47-0 vote, and therefore we respectfully request that this committee amend the bill with the A4 amendments and move it to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Thank you, Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Levy. I think before we have questions, we'll go to hear from Mr. Mahaffey.
Cool. Can I ask him a couple questions?
You can address them to me, and I can address them to him.
Cool.
But please give us your testimony.
My name is Eric Mahaffey. I'm a licensed electrician here in the state of Oregon. I regularly get called in to clean up after some of these contractor-type people that he's talking about.
Now, what contractor-type people? Because under the bill, these have to be CCB-licensed contractors. So
the laws already exist from the CCB, say anybody working on a house for pay is supposed to be a licensed contractor. So that part of his bill, in my understanding of the law, is repetitious. So I don't know. Most of this law I look at, and the laws that he's talking about seem to already exist in other places in the legislature. The only part that they don't seem to, that doesn't seem to exist, is the loosening up of the requirement to be a contractor. I know there's good people out there doing this, but I also know there's a lot of bad people out there doing this. And I'm just, right now, my kids are getting old enough to actually start purchasing homes. And I'm finding out that this is everywhere. The electrical, plumbing, structural work, if done incorrectly and unchecked, doesn't heal itself. It doesn't change. And the people out there right now that are calling themselves contractors because they can walk up to the discount desk in Home Depot are still out there working on these homes. And what this law is going to do, in my opinion, is make them think they have more rights to do what they're already doing. I get called out to do mostly repair-type work, and I deal with this on a regular basis. I have a slurry of pictures here. I'd love to show you folks and try to explain what's going on in a lot of them. The first group of pictures actually is from a house that was a turn-and-burn contractors. They buy the house with the intention of turning the house for a profit, and the person who purchased it typically ends up getting burnt. The first one is actually where somebody went out, started working on this house, and the building code was informed there was illegal work going on it. Months after the house sold, they showed up to deal with it. This is actually the porch light on the front porch. And what you're looking at is a light which is screwed directly to the 2x6 awning on the outside of the house and then wired up the side with all the wires just exposed right above the front door. This house actually passed its residential type
A4 amendments and move it to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Thank you, Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Levy. I think before we have questions, we'll go to hear from Mr. Mahaffey.
Cool. Can I ask him a couple questions?
You can address them to me, and I can address them to him. But
cool.
Please give us your testimony.
My name is Eric Mahaffey. I'm a licensed electrician here in the state of Oregon. I regularly get called in to clean up after some of these contractor-type people that he's talking about.
Now, what contractor-type people? Because under the bill, these have to be CCB-licensed contractors. So
the laws already exist from the CCB, say anybody working on a house for pay is supposed to be a licensed contractor. So that part of his bill, in my understanding of the law, is repetitious. So I don't know. Most of this law I look at, and the laws that he's talking about seem to already exist in other places in the legislature. The only part that they don't seem to, that doesn't seem to exist, is the loosening up of the requirement to be a contractor. I know there's good people out there doing this, but I also know there's a lot of bad people out there doing this. And I'm just, right now, my kids are getting old enough to actually start purchasing homes. And I'm finding out that this is everywhere. The electrical, plumbing, structural work, if done incorrectly and unchecked, doesn't heal itself. It doesn't change. And the people out there right now that are calling themselves contractors because they can walk up to the discount desk in Home Depot are still out there working on these homes. And what this law is going to do, in my opinion, is make them think they have more rights to do what they're already doing. I get called out to do mostly repair-type work, and I deal with this on a regular basis. I have a slurry of pictures here that I'd love to show you folks and try to explain what's going on in a lot of them. The first group of pictures actually is from a house that was a turn and, I call them turn and burn contractors. They buy the house with the intention of turning the house for a profit, and the person who purchased it typically ends up getting burnt. The first one is actually where somebody went out, started working on this house, and the building code was informed there was illegal work going on it. Months after the house sold, they showed up to deal with it. This is actually the porch light on the front porch. And what you're looking at is a light which is screwed directly to the 2x6 awning on the outside of the house and then wired up the side with all the wires just exposed right above the front door. This house actually passed its residential type inspection where they come out and look at it, and this wasn't mentioned in the inspection report. They put this awning out the side of the house where they ran out. They made the dining room bigger, and they didn't put an outlet out there in the dining room. I was ending to have to rewire that. They put a light in this little awning directly above it, and if you look up in there, they have a 10-gauge wire coming into it on a 14-gauge circuit, so the wire is way too big. The wire nuts that come with it aren't rated for that size wire, so they were loose. The light is installed on a 4-square box, which does not accept that kind of fixture. So the person who installed this, in order to fix it, took a piece of 2x4, cut it down, stuck it inside the box, and screwed the adapter to the inside of that electrical box. We're still in the same house. We've moved into the primary bathroom. They extended out the box above the bathroom and left exposed wires across the top. The main reason I got called is when the inspector came into the house, they took the cover plates off of these two switches and this plug and looked inside and realized they weren't properly supported. I did the same, realized they weren't properly supported, and figured out the easiest way into this wall was to go into the hallway and cut open the wall. I found two boxes inside there which were just buried. They're supposed to be cover plates on the inside of that, because all junction boxes are supposed to be accessible so you can fix the wiring that's inside of it. Let's continue on over this way. There was a light switch sitting right next to that on the side for a light inside the closet, which is so close to the fabric and the material inside the closet that if you actually stuffed your shelf the way most people do and then leave that light on, it'll catch the house on fire. On top of that, the ground wire is just twisted around the switch. We're now moving into the master bathroom. This is a light switch that's on the outside. Once again, by taking the cover plate off and shining a flashlight inside, you can see that the knockout in the back was knocked up and left open. You can see the wire supports are missing, and you can also see that the ground screw the ground wire and screw are not connected. Once again, this was left in the house. I went into that bathroom. I took down the mirror above the sink and the light fixture and discovered that the light fixture was not going into a junction box. This is all one house, one time going through it. I found the light switch directly below it. It was a cut-in box. I was able to remove it. I noticed the wire between the light and the light switch were different. I stuck my hand inside that box, inside that hole, and I found a junction box down low, also buried, and a junction box up high, also buried. When I opened up the lower junction box, I discovered that they had wires that were exposed where they could energize the box accidentally, and the grounding connection is, once again, just twisted. There's only two out of the three that are made up. And the box itself is not grounded, so if for some reason that box became energized, it would just have electricity on it just sitting there in the wall. Nothing to short it out or blow the breaker. This is another house, another contractor. They bought this house. They actually thought that their son could work on the electrical of the house because they owned the home. They bought him a book from Home Depot and said, here, please wire the house. Well, they gave up on him being able to finish it and hired me to come in. If you look at this, they're putting in can lights directly above the kitchen, and if you pay attention, they actually cut through the beams of the house so the can lights could go where they wanted to go. That whole upstairs was bouncing up and down. You couldn't even walk around up there because three major supports got cut out. It was shaking the sheetrock loose, and of course they were upset at me for trouncing around too hard up there. The only reason that house didn't fall down is the whole thing's put together with tongue and groove everywhere. The kid who was wiring this seemed to think that you could run a 20-amp circuit in and take it out on two 15-amp wires. He left no cover on the box and knocked out all of his connections. all of his clamps that are supposed to be in there. So if something actually did fail inside that box, the molten metal, which does happen sometimes on wire nuts, could drip out of the box and onto the metal, the wood down below it, and catch the house on fire. This is another one where we fed it with a 30-amp circuit breaker, connected it to a 20-amp wire and a 15-amp wire. He used a junction box with 3/4-inch knockouts in it and tried to install a bunch of half-inch devices by balancing them on the wire. Once again, if you look, the grounds are just twisted together and the box itself is not grounded. Same house, once again, blew out all of his connections down on the boxes. They bought this house with intention of selling it, and if their kid could have gotten it running, this would have ended up on the market. Anyways, all the boxes are knocked out, all the connections are knocked out. Here we have two wires under one ground screw. This is another house. This is a turn and burn contractor who likes to go in and remodel bathrooms and also goes out and flips houses for a part of his main business.
Okay, I'm stuck there, Mr. Hattie. This is very interesting, but I'm trying to juxtapose this with this bill. I mean, so let me ask you a couple of questions so we can understand, because I want to know how this bill would change any of that. I mean, what you either have, correct me if I'm wrong, this is supposed to be done by a licensed contractor.
Correct.
So either this was done by a licensed contractor and they're no good, or it wasn't done by a licensed contractor, which doesn't change anything under this bill. I mean, someone violated the law. I'm trying to understand what the connection is between what you're saying is that someone who was not authorized to do this did the work, mm-hmm. which they would do now or do under this bill. I don't understand the connection.
Basically, the public's opinion is that if they own the house, they can do anything they want to it. The law, present law, the way it's stated, says that that's not true. If you're working right. on a house, it needs to have a permit. If you own the house and you want to do your electrical work, that doesn't mean you can do it any old way you want to. You still have right. to get a permit, and you still have to have inspections. The easiest way I can look at what this law is proposing, the main part of the body of this law, is it seems to be allowing someone to flip four houses a year.
Yeah, basically it means the realtor doesn't have to be licensed. As a contractor, assuming whoever the owner is of these properties, but would still have to use a licensed contractor. I'm just trying to think of why this would not continue to go on under this bill.
Public perception is almost more important than law, and right now the public does know that they have to be a licensed contractor, but they also know there's no bite, there's no follow through. And they know that they don't have as much responsibility if they claim themselves as a contractor, although they're not, and they sell the house as a homeowner, because then the house, as I understand it, sells as is. I have several people who do this, and they don't want to become a contractor because it holds them up to a higher level of responsibility.
Well, I'll tell you what we'll do. Let me, because we have a lot of bills. I think
let me give you one quick example of why I'm against this, and I'll move on. The law says 55. If you're going to drive on the road, you go 55 miles an hour. We all know, because enforcement lets you get away with 10 miles an hour over, most of us don't go 55 miles an hour. All right? This law basically says that you can turn and burn houses legally. That's like taking the law saying, well, we're already going 65. Let's make the speed limit 65. Well, people aren't going to stop at 65. They're going to keep pushing it up to 75. All right, so I am vehemently against anything that gives the public the perception that they don't need a contractor's license in order to be able to work on a house.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think what we'll do, fortunately we have Mr. Smith here from the Construction Contractors Board, so I would, even though he's not set to testify on this bill, would you mind coming up for a moment? And I mean, you've heard the testimony here, and I think what the committee needs to know is, I mean, Mr. Mahaffey's concerns are very legitimate. The question is, are they related to this bill, and your view on the testimony Mr. Mahaffey had in terms of how this bill might impact those problems?
Chair Metzger and members of the committee, Craig Smith, Construction Contractors Board, and my testimony on the other side was that this is a policy issue, and I still maintain that it is one that CCB doesn't weigh in on, but one that the legislature needs to decide on. I think that Mr. Mahaffey makes some good points, and that is that some folks that buy homes, fix them up, and sell them, they don't do a very good job. This bill would not change that. This bill requires someone who buys a home to use licensed contractors to fix it up. So I think your confusion or concern that, well, this bill doesn't really address this problem is probably right on target. However, again, I hate to flip-flop back and forth here.
We like neutral parties on these bills.
I can't tell you this is the best piece of legislation I've ever seen this year. And the best thing I can say about it is most people don't know that buying a home, fixing it up a little, and putting it on the market requires a contractor's license. A few licensed contractors do, and the real estate industry does. However, because it's not well known doesn't mean that it shouldn't be maintained to be Oregon law. And so I don't think this bill is going to do a lot of bad things for the public. I think that the bill clearly has a potential for legalizing activity that's currently going on that is not particularly dangerous, and that's simply buying a home, putting a coat of paint on it, maybe trying to repair the electricity using a licensed electrician.
Well, if I understand the bill correctly, if someone wants to hire a licensed electrician, they can no longer do this themselves, because I believe there's a part in there that says if somebody needs to pull a permit, that they can't do this. They have to pass it on to a general contractor. Well, any electrical work you're going to do, any plumbing work you're going to do, or any HVAC work you're going to do all requires a permit. So at that point, this bill is null and void. So if the person wants to do anything more than paint the house and regrow the lawn, which is what all these turn and burn contractors claim they do, this bill is null and void.
Okay, let's see if we have any questions from the committee. Questions? Senator Droege.
Harlan, I guess that the biggest concern I have here, and it doesn't stop me from generally supporting what you want to do here, but is that as a member of the public, I put a house in the market. A realtor comes to me, and I think they're representing my realtor interest, but they could be in the business, as I read this, of turning houses and having two businesses. One is a realtor, and one is one of these flippers. And so, in essence, a realtor could come in and say, "Oh yeah, this house is worth $200,000. I'll buy it from you." You see what I'm saying? It could increase kind of the conflict within your industry. And how would you guys deal with that?
Chair Metzger, Senator Droege, we didn't bring this bill for the purpose of benefiting the realtors. This bill was brought because realtors' clients are doing this and want to continue to do this. And the problem that we found was a lot of our members don't even know that this is the current status of the law. And in so doing, in assisting their clients to do this, they're potentially at risk of a license law violation themselves. So we're doing this for realtors' clients, for members of the public. And we think this will have a beneficial effect on the housing inventories around the state, because what you're going to see happen is people that want to use their capital to fix up existing homes, to fix up, you know, that dilapidated foreclosure down on the corner with the weeds growing tall that nobody wants to do anything with, that's become an eyesore, that's dragging everybody else's property values down, they're going to be able to do this. And the bill has adequate safeguards in it to ensure that the public is protected. Yes, this bill isn't going to fix the problem that you're seeing up there on the screen, but that wasn't the intent of this bill. Those are two different issues. The issue that this bill is addressing is the issue of housing inventory and people that want to improve existing housing in their neighborhoods, in their communities. This will legalize it and let them do that so long as they have licensed contractors that are doing the work. Now, I did want to respond to one thing that the gentleman here mentioned with respect to getting a general contractor. If you look at the text of the exemption that we're adding, on line 5, page 2, it talks about this. And a plumber or electrician would still be doing the work. They would just be doing it under the direction of a general contractor. And this is something we put into the bill at the request of the construction industry. They had some concerns about subcontractors not being supervised in some of these jobs. So we threw that in as additional consumer protection. So what you would have is the electrician actually doing the work, obtaining the permit, but they'd be under the direction of a general contractor. So there would be a whole nother layer of consumer protection built into this exemption.
I think what this could actually do is force people that are trying to use this to hide their own electrical and hide their own plumbing. Because at that point, they are throwing a whole other layer into it. And what these people flipping houses are trying to do is keep the cost down. I'm a contractor by trade. I could actually buy a house. I could fix it up. I could sell it back to the general public. But because of the house flippers, the people are going in, painting the walls, cleaning the carpets, putting out a green lawn, and stuffing all this in the walls and making it disappear, I can't afford to buy a house. I can't afford to fix up the houses that are out there because I have to put a lot more money into the house to bring it back up to functional, not just looking good. And these people basically just make the house look good because they can get the same amount of money for the house looking good as you can looking good and working good. The public, when they first go in to buy a house, buy it on looks, and then they live in it for a period of time and discover that it's not in best of shape. So if you want to see the inventory of the houses in this state improve, then make contractors fix them up and be responsible for the work that's in the house and taking care of it. The house flipper wants to make money. And they're not going to spend as much on the house to make that money, so they can afford to pay more for it. So if I want to go in and fix the house up and bring it back to specs, I can't afford to compete with these people because I know what the house is going to sell for when it's done, and by having to pay this slightly inflated high price from these people that are doing this, I can't compete. So we just step aside. If I wish somebody would take me up on a challenge, I would like to go out and look through 20 randomly selected houses with plumbers, electricians, with people that are in spec, and give them a fine-tooth comb. And I will bet you that 80% of the homes we walk into are going to be wrecked in some form or another. Putting a nice coat of paint on them, fixing the holes in the wall, and cleaning the lawn is not going to take care of these problems. By having somebody who can spend a couple weeks learning what it takes to become a contractor and paying a few $1,000s for license and bond, that shouldn't put an issue in someone trying to flip 4 houses a year. If you want to continue with this bill, I think this bill does have some merit, but I'd make it a once-in-a-lifetime exception, and I would allow these people to directly hire electricians and plumbers. But 4 times a year, that's a business. They need a license.
Thank you, Mr. Mahaffey. Other questions? Yeah. Senator Mona Sanderson.
I'd like to know if the question of liability has something to do with this, and is this why you don't want the flipper to have a license? Because then if something truly was found wrong, then the liability would be on the contractor, the licensed contractor, rather than on the owner.
Chair Metzger, Senator Mona Sanderson. In a previous draft of the bill, we had a pass-through of liability for the contractors. The building industry objected to that, and there was a pretty significant fiscal attached with that. So as a compromise, we took that out of the bill. However, I can tell you that this bill still is going to have liability for the seller, the flipper. If the flipper is out there selling houses to consumers that have defects, material defects, they need to be disclosed. If they are not disclosed, then they are liable under common law and under various statutes. They have committed a misrepresentation, and they're going to be found liable for damage, and theoretically the consumer might even be able to make them take the house back. So there is protection built in. In addition to that, most of most of the sales that are occurring, residential sales that are occurring today, are using a form that has an inspection contingency within it, which allows the buyer to have the house inspected by a professional home inspector, and then gives the buyer an unconditional right to withdraw their offer should they reject the results of the inspection. Now, not everybody is using that form, but I can tell you that if they're using a realtor to purchase their house, they're probably using that form. And we recommend that, all homes have an inspection done before the home is closed. So there are several different layers of protection built in to the existing law, to the contract between the parties, and we think this bill is still going to protect the consumer.
Okay. Do you have a follow-up on that?
Yes, in a sense I do. And I'm trying to phrase it. Either way, if the flipper isn't licensed, either way you still have to have inspections, correct? Depending on the work. I mean, if you have electrical, if you have plumbing, those types of things.
Chair Metzger, Senator Monsanto, those are different inspections. Those are inspections done at the time that the person pulls a permit, sure. What I was referring to is a home inspection that would be done by the buyer after they made an offer prior to closing. But yes, those types of activities are going to require an inspection as well. But that's an inspection done by the permitting authority.
Mr. Mahaffey, you had a comment to that?
Well, if you could ask this gentleman a question for me. My concern is this bill actually offering anything new other than allowing people to flip four houses a year? I don't think it is.
Mr. Levy.
Senator Metzger, members of the committee, what the bill is doing is it is creating a situation for people to do what they're already doing. And what we're doing here is we are allowing people to own homes, to have them fixed up by licensed contractors, and to put them back onto the market. That is not a bad thing. That is happening all over. It is not just happening in Oregon. And the difference is, in Oregon, it's being done illegally. In most other states, it's happening legally. I mean, there are TV shows on cable about this. Flip this house, flip that house, the property ladder. My wife loves these shows. She makes me watch them all the time. So this is happening. This is the business that is occurring. This is the reflection of the marketplace in which we are in today. And this bill maintains many of the existing requirements. Many of the existing requirements. The only thing that is removed is the requirement that the owner themselves be a licensed contractor.
Okay. I know this is unfair to you, Mr. Smith, but I need your expertise on this. Is there anything in this bill that you think would make that more clear or comfortable to accomplish what Mr. Levy is saying? Mr. Mahaffey has his concerns. I mean, is there some language missing here that you think would be helpful to accomplish that and maintain some of the concerns that have been expressed?
Chair Metzger is a member of the committee. I worked with Mr. Levy last week and with your committee administrator to add the one word that I thought would help, and that's the dash four amendment, adding the word existing.
Mm-hmm.
Beyond that, I think the legislation is pretty clear. It's a policy choice. Do you want to open this up the way the rest of America has operated? I got to tell you, I don't think that many homes in the rest of the country are going to pot because people flip houses. I got to tell you that. At the same time, I can tell you that I've seen people that get involved, not unlike this, thinking that law allows you to do this, and they do some pretty crummy work. Sometimes they cover it up, and it isn't seen by the buyer until much later. Sometimes it's rotten wood. Sometimes it's wiring like this.
And then who would be responsible for that? Let's say I had one of these houses that Mr. Mahaffey, you know, has pointed out, and I bring him in because something happens, or I get a spark or something, and they discover all this. What's my recourse on this?
Well, Senator Metzger, I think that the recourse is a lawsuit against the seller.
Mm-hmm.
Do you agree?
I mean, if they covered it up or had it covered up, then they would be liable for that because they did not disclose. Is that correct?
Yes, Senator Metzger, I believe the standard is known or should have known.
Right.
And if they do not disclose the material fact that the electricity is faulty, they are going to be liable.
Okay. Mr. Mahaffey, then we're going to move on here.
I appreciate your time. The house flipping program that he's talking about, the few times that I've watched it, they were actually catching people and doing totally illegal things to homes. It is unfortunately painting a rather poor example of what needs to be happening out there. As I understand it, also just takes a couple of weeks of education and a very small amount of money to actually become a contractor. So I don't see why a person should be scared of becoming a contractor other than they're just trying to escape a liability issue. I'm very proud of the fact that Oregon has dug its heels in and is trying to improve the quality of the American home. And I'm not sure if this is doing that. I think it's giving the public the wrong opinion. Once again, if you are going to continue with this bill, I would appreciate it if you would not do four times a year. That's a business. One lifetime exception for the guy who's learning about it or trying to figure it out or something along that lines, fine. If you're also going to do this bill, allow the person to hire an electrician directly and hire a plumber directly. Otherwise, what you're doing is you're discouraging them from telling you the truth. There are some, yeah, this bill does have some good merits. Yes, the person who's flipping houses should be liable for what they're doing. But once again, the liability issues that have been talked about are not part of this bill. They already exist, to the best of my knowledge. So why not insist the person hang a shingle and be right and be legal and be in a position where they can be held to a higher standard to improve the quality of the homes that all of us live in?
Yeah, I had a question from Senator George.
Real quick question. I just want kind of a real brief answer. The house that you showed us where there are the can lights on top, that they had their son do it from a Home Depot book, he would have to have a permit to do that kind of electrical work.
Correct.
So they were violating the law,
yes,
by doing
present
that.
Law. And this
okay.
is, but this is standard. This is
normal. That's all I want to know. I just want to make sure that they were violating the law the way currently is doing that.
And they'd still be
okay.
violating it the way he's
right.
talking.
Okay.
I have one quick question,
yes.
too. To get a license, what does it cost? I mean, for someone who wants to flip houses, what's involved? A test?
Chair Metzger and Senator Montes Anderson, the Construction Contractors Board does have a test for folks that have not been working in the construction industry for several years. And the test is costs $106. Study for it by private vendors to do the education. The fee for contractor's license is $130 a year. Usually people get two-year licenses, some get four-year licenses. The real cost and burden is the acquisition of liability insurance. That liability insurance can be problematic to get. It can be expensive depending on the kind of work that you're doing. The bond that contractors get is relatively small in size. It's a $15,000 bond. You're going to hear more about that as the week progresses. But for folks that have poor credit, it can be very expensive to get. So there is a process of elimination, not so much by the government, but by the folks offering insurance and bonding that are requirements to get a contractor's license.
So is that, Mr. Levy, the primary reason why you would like to see this bill happen?
Chair Metzger, Senator Montes Anderson, yes. The problem that my members have found is the cost of the liability insurance makes it so that a newly married couple that is trying to do, you know, one of these is not going to be able to afford the insurance. It becomes so cost prohibitive that it doesn't make the prospect worthwhile. So that is the entry barrier that we see.
So the people doing this are uninsured?
But so I'm trying to still get my hands on this. Choosing four houses that you want to fix up is a lot. I mean, if I was an individual, I'd choose one, if that. Four seems like quite a few houses to flip in a year.
Senator Metzger, Senator Montes-Anderson, yeah, four was just a number that we reached in negotiations with the construction industry. That is just the number that we put into the bill. I'm sure that, you know, I'd be able to talk to my folks if it was the desire of this committee to reduce that number. That's an amendment that we might consider.
Because I would think that if you are doing that many houses in a year, that maybe there should be some liability insurance. I don't know, you know. This isn't my area.
I tell you what we're going to do. Thank you, Senator. I think what we're going to do, we're just going to hold the bill right now, close public hearing on House Bill 2498. We'll chat about this. We've got a lot of stuff to do, and I want to make sure we get to that. Thank you all for coming.
Thank you.
Let's open up public hearing on House Bill 2567. Janet?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Finally, Mr. Chair, we get to see the retractable set of tires.
I know you've been excited about this.
I ran over to the House hearing room just after they took it away. House Bill 2567, and you should have the A in gross bill, would require that tires with retractable studs be allowed as traction tires under Oregon's Transportation Commission rules. And allow the tire dealer to sell tires equipped with non-lightweight studs if the studs are retractable. Came on a House vote of 50-0 and sponsored by the Committee on Transportation. Thank you.
Okay. Let's ask Cindy Robert and Dan Peterson to come forward, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Cindy. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Cindy Robert, and I'm proud to represent Q-Tires in Oregon. Usually as a lobbyist doing this for 17 years, I'm coming to talking to you about policy, and after I speak, someone else comes and speaks on the other side. I'm happy about this bill because I'm talking to you about product, and there is nobody on the other side. So far,
we don't know yet.
We're learning quick.
So far, this bill has been received with great amazement and kudos. Just walking through the hall with it the first time I brought it in, got me stopped by the police officer several times, but also by people who are very interested in what we're doing. This bill simply makes it so that the exemptions right now in statute are extended to retractable studded tires. Statute says you cannot have any metal on your tire. This simply makes it so that you can if it's a retractable studded tire that is also under the rulemaking authority of ODOT. ODOT helped us draft this bill in its original form. They then drafted the amendments for the secondary form, the A and gross, passed out of committee, House Transportation Committee unanimously after they were kind enough with the leadership of Representative Beyer to introduce the bill, and as you've heard, passed out of the committee unanimously. One of the other exciting things about this tire and the company on the whole is that it's a West Coast company. It's the founder of the company, the idea, the patent behind this tire lives in Tualatin, as do many of the other board members and the investors. And with me today is Daniel Peterson, one of those. And I'm hoping we'll tell you a little bit more about our story because it is exciting.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Peterson. I think the story is real exciting, but I would particularly be more interested in the tire itself, just because I have other people who want to get their bills passed.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Do you want to just look at the tire?
Tell me how it works and where you are in terms of its availability for the market.
Okay. Well, the way that it works is the tire is constructed in two parts. There's the main chamber of the tire, which is just like any standard tire. And then there is a secondary chamber that exists beneath the standard tread just as any other tire, but we have developed a secondary chamber which consists of these pods where the studs are embedded and the grooves that connect them. There's a small valve that connects the main chamber, air chamber of the tire, into this network of secondary chambers. A simple flip of a switch, and this version doesn't have the remote control device, but the one that is the tire that's coming to market will have a like a garage door opener that sits on your visor. You push the button once, it releases air, small amount of air, from the main chamber of the tire into this network of secondary chambers, which then push the metal studs up so that they then are above or even with the surface of the tread. That creates enough traction on packed snow and ice to enable motorists to drive safely on those road conditions. But it's important to note that the metal does not come in contact with the roadway, whether the studs are deployed or not, because they're in contact with the snow and ice when they're deployed. When they're retracted, they sit below the tread surface. Another flip of the same switch exhausts the air in this secondary network of chambers out to atmosphere, and the studs then retract due to the memory of the rubber, which then puts the top of the stud below the wear bar of the tire. The intent of the tire is to create a safety device that's usable by motorists year-round, so that they only have to buy one set of tires that can be used summer, fall, winter, in any driving conditions.
How's the reliability been of the process? Testing.
We have done a lot of laboratory testing. We are just now, this week, doing road testing down in San Angelo, Texas, in that area where there's extensive tire testing that's done to a couple of different standards. And so I can't talk about the results of the test because they're not in yet, but we've done fine in the laboratory setting, and we've passed what's called FMVSS 139, which is the U.S. Department of Transportation standard with this tire.
See, my luck is I would hit the button to exhaust the air, and all the air would go out. And I'd have four flat tires. Anyway, this is very fascinating. Senator George, you have a question?
Yeah, real quickly, just so I understand. As the normal rubber tread wears down, how do you not end up having the metal above the tread?
Yes, and Cindy, if you could show that, we've got another sample here too. The way the studs are designed when they're retracted is that they sit at the wear bar of the tire. And it's only when they're extended that they go up. So that at the wear bar, the tire needs to be removed from the road in any event. I mean, that's law in every state. And so the tire is essentially illegal at that point. It's not safe to be driven on roadways. And so since the tire has to be removed at that point anyway, the metal is, I mean, the tire is not going to be worn down to the point where the metal will be contacting the roadway. I hope that's clear.
So yeah, what's the wear and tear, Mr. Chair? Yes. Is the wear and tear the same life? Is the life of the tire the same as an ordinary tire?
Yes, it is. This needs to be viewed just like any other all-season tire. It's been designed so that there's exactly the same amount of tread depth as you have on any tire that you go down and buy at Les Schwab. Most tires are produced with either 10 or 11 32nds of rubber that's usable. And at 2 32nds, the tire is unusable. It's unsafe. It has to be taken off the car.
So just one other question. The wear and tear on the roads, I mean, everyone says how our roads are being destroyed.
Right.
And so is this really going to save our roads?
Well, it depends on how many people buy the tire, of course. In lieu of permanently studded tires. The research that we came across as we developed our business plan showed that Oregon State University had done a study that showed that there was about $50 million a year of road damage done in Oregon due to the use of studded tires. We don't intend or claim that we'll solve that problem, but we do feel as if we can make an improvement in that problem, that those who use this tire year-round won't be wearing out Oregon roadways when there's not snow and ice on the streets.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Martin Sanderson, let me add to that as well. One of the things that's interesting about studded tires on the whole is when a regular studded tire is in use and there's no snow or ice on the ground, the safety of that tire, the safety of the passengers is absolutely compromised. The stopping time with a studded tire when there's no snow and ice is extended far out. So not only do we think we'll be saving the roads, and maybe Dan can toot our horn, but I can, we absolutely think we'll be saving millions of dollars in the state of Oregon and all across the West. And we've already had three other states implement this needed language to make this change to studded tire statute. But we think we'll save roads and we'll help save lives, too, because those studded tires don't need to be used that often where you drive as compared to where Senator Metzger drives. And so we need to make sure that the studs are bought in when they're not used. Furthermore, one of the questions that's been asked over and over again is about this the tread wear and if the stud will ever touch the surface. On those pieces you have, they are dimpled. On this tire, I have an earlier prototype that I've been stashing around the Capitol, and the newer prototype has the dimples. This one just doesn't. So you'll see that usually they are dimpled beneath. Furthermore, it'll be very clear when your studs are deployed. Thank you. It'll be very clear that they are, and if that by either a color change or a change on the light on your dashboard, and if there's a wear, it will not only be clear to you, but it'll be clear to the police officer going down the road because of the color change that we're hoping to put underneath the tread, even though the studs will never hit the road anyway. Which is another interesting point. If I show you the introduction, if I might, Mr. Chair, one of the things that you'll see is it doesn't actually look like the studs come out far enough to hit the snow, but of course it does due to the weight of the tire on the weight of the car on the tire.
For those.
There it is. Okay. So right now, they're down. They're retracted. And normally, with the dimpled piece that I show you, it would be dimpled down. And then with the flip of the switch on your dash, you can see they're going out. And it doesn't seem like it's that much. It would be if they were dimpled to begin with. It doesn't seem like it's that big of a difference. But with the weight of the car and the tire, the studs will actually touch the ice.
This is electronic.
Yes, it's electronic. You know, right now, I was describing to someone else earlier. Right now, in a lot of the Chevy vehicles, they can tell you what your tire pressure is in your tire, and that's all done through computer chip that's in this valve. And this will be done the same way.
Technology.
I know, it's really
Well, now, Mr. Peterson, so... let's say that this is being used commercially, and as was mentioned, you know, the tire starts to wear, so that even in a retracted mode, you know, because someone hasn't replaced their tires, that those studs might still then have an impact on the road. I'm just trying to think of how do we get those tires off the road at that point, because the statute says they can have them, but it's under the assumption that they're retracted and... But, you know, now they're acting essentially like studs in summer.
If I might answer that actually for you, Mr. Chair, that's one of the reasons that the bill was changed from its original form, which just took the studded tire out of the studded tire law.
Right.
Now it's the studded tire under ODOT rulemaking to make sure that we look at each situation that could happen in that light, problems that would occur. They are still following the rulemaking for the particular retractable studded tire. It's not all metal tire exemption. It's just for the retractable studded tire under rule.
Okay. Mr. Peterson, you know when you anticipate this might be commercially available?
Yes, we anticipate this coming winter driving season.
Okay. Well, it'll be very interesting. Actually, despite where I live, Miss Robert, I don't have studs on my car. And even though I've lived in Mount Hood for 20 years, we don't have any studs on our car and don't need them. And my feeling has always been if the road was that bad, I don't want to be out there having people bang the heck out of my car. So I find other alternatives to that. And I know Senator George's father has been one who has, and I have tried to get rid of these of studs on the road because of the damage they do, and I think the false sense of security when the majority of days are they are actually a liability rather than a benefit, but that argument's for another day. But I do wish you success with this technology, because if you are successful with this, then it could provide another alternative down the road where we won't have to have the conventional studs on the road day in, day out, in which there's no snow or ice and we're just simply tearing up. I think those of you who do, and I think everybody in this room does, drive down to Salem from Portland at some point or another just before the Wilson River Bridge on I-5 and practically throw your car out of control because the ruts are so deep in that section of the highway. Anyway.
We like to call it water skiing.
Yeah. Any other questions from the committee? Nope, that's open. Close the work session. Public hearing, hold a work session on House Bill 2567.
Thank you very much. I move House Bill 2567A to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Okay, Senator Mona Sanderson has moved House Bill 2567A to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Discussion? Objection? So ordered, and I'll carry the bill and mark our other two companions as excused. There you go. And thanks, Vanna, for your help in exhibiting the... Yeah, thank you very much. Let's open up public hearing on House Bill 2473. Janet.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2473 would reduce required apprenticeship time for a limited journeyman sign electrician and a limited journeyman stage electrician from 4 years to 2 years, and a Class A limited energy technician license from 4 years to 3 years. It clarifies what limited maintenance electricians can do, and on that provision, there are at your place A2 amendments that would put the new limitations on everything but industrial plants. So the new limitation in subsection 2 sub 10 would apply to the voltages on non-industrial plants. And again, this is for a limited electrician license. And it removes certain electrician licenses that are no longer necessary in the statute, and says that a license is removed from the statute will expire at the end of the term that they currently have, and they will not be renewed. Mr. Chair, there are a couple of people to testify, and again, the A2 amendments should be at your place.
Well, I only have one person signed up, Nathan Phillips.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Nathan Phillips. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I served on the State Electrical Board and Elevator Board for 12 years and was chair for three, and this bill is something that industry has crafted to clean up some problems in the electrical licensing laws. We eliminate three or four or five licenses that are unused, that have no license holders, so just getting them out of statute, and we're responding to stakeholder requests to reduce the apprenticeship requirements so that they're more in line with the training necessary to safely perform the work. That's pretty much what it is. It's a pretty simple cleanup kind of thing.
Mr. Miller, I understand the A2 amendments are yours. If you want to come forward, just stay here, Mr. Phillips, please.
Good afternoon, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Greg Miller. I'm the public affairs manager for Weyerhaeuser Company, and we ask that the dash A2s on the amendment to allow our LMEs and our facilities and our industrial plant sites to continue to do the business that they do currently. So that's the purpose of the amendment.
Okay. And have you and Mr. Phillips talked about those amendments?
Yes. Yes.
And would you be in concurrence with those amendments? Okay. Okay. Well, we certainly want to keep our apprenticeship program working in the right direction and getting the right training and getting people who are qualified to take these jobs and not doing things that aren't necessary either, because it's such an important part of that. Do we have any questions for either of our guests? You get luckier than some people in this committee. We're going to close the public hearing, open a work session with an A2 amendment before
us. Mr. Chair, I move the A2 amendments to House Bill 2473.
Okay, Senator Montes Anderson has moved the A2 amendment to House Bill 2473. Discussion? Objection? So ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2473 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Now, Senator Montes Anderson has moved House Bill 2473 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Discussion? Objection? So ordered. Senator George, would you carry this one for us? Well, George will carry, and then we'll mark Senator Starr and Deputy excuse. Okay, let's open up a public hearing on House Bill 2475. Janet.
Chair, House Bill 2475 would allow the Department of Consumer and Business Services in construction with the Electrical and Elevator Board to adopt rules regarding usage of a written request by a licensed supervising electrician as an authority to energize electrical installations. Under current law, sometimes it... an installation needs to be re-energized right away, and there's no time for a required inspection, and this would allow rulemaking to allow those types of things to be re-energized under a supervising electrician. You should have the A and gross bill, and there are no amendments.
Well, that sounds wonderful. You know, the legislature needs to be re-energized. Let me find out how that works. Mr. Phelps, you want to come back forward and tell us about re-energizing? For those of us lay people on the committee.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, my name is Nathan Phillips, members of the committee. This has been in statute for a long time. When we go out as electricians and make emergency repairs, if we don't have time for an inspection, we can write a letter authorizing the utility to reconnect it, and then the inspection takes place afterwards so we can get facilities back online. The problem that we've got is that there are no rules around these letters, and the utilities all over the state and the local jurisdictions have various ways of interpreting it. In some places, they're not assuring that the inspection takes place after the reconnection has occurred, and some places they won't accept the letter. So we have long wanted to have a standardized way of approaching this, and this bill would give the Building Codes Division the authority to write a rule that would make it clear what the letter needed to do and say.
Okay.
Is that energizing?
Yeah, energizing.
Great.
Any questions?
This kind of thing is really important when you're building a new site and trying to bring it online. So,
yeah.
Really.
Okay.
Particularly for a change of service on your house, that's when it comes up most often.
That's what happened to me.
Yeah. Okay, let's close the public hearing. We'll open a work session on House Bill 2475.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2475 to the floor with the due pass.
Okay, Senator Montes Anderson has moved House Bill 2475 to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Discussion? Objection? So ordered. Senator George, would you carry this one? I have a kind of a keep in the flow there, and we'll mark our other two colleagues as excused. Now, that completes our agenda for the day. So, just to recap, members, I have heard that the bill 3485, in which Mr. Martinez testified that there was a mistake on the amendment, the word I received from the proponent, as well as Mr. Martinez, is that it is correct, that it should have an amendment, and they've agreed on that, so we're going to let them make that amendment, bring the bill back to us. And we'll have further discussions on the other bill that didn't come out, but And one other thing, we were going to have a meeting this week in the evening, but because of the schedules of everybody, it just doesn't work out. So we're going to have our one evening meeting moved till next week, next Wednesday, which will be the eve of our last committee meeting. We would like to schedule an evening meeting. So hopefully people can have their schedules adjusted, so we'll meet at, you know, our normal time a week from Wednesday and then come back at 5 to help try to get through whatever workload we possibly can. And I appreciate everybody's attentiveness to that.
Senator George. On that House Bill 3485,
yes,
affordable housing, the question I was going to ask the proponents when they came back in was, what happens if you have a nonprofit and then that nonprofit goes to funk? So I bought a, you know, you buy a house from them and 10 years later you go to sell it and that nonprofit no longer exists. And I was going to ask them when they came, see if it would be, if they'd be available either for an amendment.
Well, I tell you what, we got up, you know, we do have a moment. We're done early, and we have, so let's, let me reopen the work session on House Bill 3485 and just see if we can get that question answered.
Let me ask a question, because that was, if they're going to do an amendment anyway.
Sure.
I just want to make sure it's clarified.
Sure. And please re-identify yourself.
Tad Everhart with the Community Development Law Center. Thank you, Senator Mester. Senator George, in answer to your question, the covenant can have more than one affordable housing covenant holder. So what we might do with organizations that are a little shaky or don't have much track record is have a second affordable housing covenant holder, maybe a more established organization, long-term organization. In addition, the covenant can afford a third party a right to enforce a covenant. So that could, if a local government were willing, or a service district, or just a general entity that everyone's very sure will be a long-term organization, that could be named as a party that has a third party right to enforce a covenant. So even if the original nonprofit goes out of business or the second nonprofit goes out of business, there could be basically a sheet to the wind to hold on to.
Mr. Chairman, I guess if you guys are going to do an amendment anyway, because it was sort of a small little question I had, I figured there'd be legislation in the future to do it. Do an amendment anyway. It'd be nice to have what happens if nobody ends up getting that right transferred to them. That maybe somehow the homeowner owns a property and they've owned it for 20 years and they go up and they say, okay, I got this covenant, and they can't find anybody who's responsible for enforcing that covenant. It's not, there's no jurisdiction, no special district or anybody, that somehow they could get out from underneath that. It would be really nice if that particular process was a little more clearly defined. It's not going to affect my support of the bill, but since you guys are going to be doing amendments anyway, it'd be really nice if you guys could work that issue out a little bit more clearly so the landowner isn't stuck someday with a piece of property that nobody cares about, and they could...
So your concern would be that somebody who's not couldn't sign off on it because they don't exist anymore.
Exactly. I want to be able to people back out of this program if it becomes some point in the future, and if the nonprofit, for instance, goes away and they did not assign their covenant to somebody, then the landowner is sort of in this endless loop of how do I get the property out from underneath the covenant. And all I'm saying is that it seems like to me there ought to be an escape valve.
Yeah.
If there's nobody who the covenant's been transferred to.
Yeah, that makes sense to me. I would agree, Ted, but probably they're good enough that that wouldn't happen. But it could happen.
Right.
And if it could, who's going to, you know, somebody would probably be coming back to us saying, hey, I got a person we can't sell the place because someone didn't do that. Would it be possible in your amendment to provide some kind of language that, you know, if in fact all the covenant holders, you know, were defunct, that a landowner would be able to, you know, transfer the property? Again, that's an unlikely situation, but Senator George is right. It could happen. Someone could just do it loosely with some organization who had one covenant holder, and then they went out of business, and maybe not your organization, but someone else who hadn't thought of that, and now we have somebody in legal limbo who can't get title to sell, and there's no one else to claim that position.
It's an obscure concern.
You know, but it's a good one because those, you know, a lot of things that we have in this committee are because no one ever thought of that could have happened. Would you mind adding something like that to that amendment, just, you know, as a fail-safe?
Sure.
And then that'll make things a lot clearer.
Okay. We've been privileged to get pro bono help from lawyers from two of the biggest title companies, and they helped us with, you know, the recording requirement and to make sure that they can track these with the title records. But in fact, a lot of property is encumbered by restrictions, and there's no person that can remove those.
Right.
Right. We'll address that.
And that would be a problem. If you could do that, it'd be great. We don't have a lot of time, so, but other than that, I think we want to move the board's bill forward. So we'd appreciate that. Thank you very much, Senator George, for bringing that up. We're going to close the public hearing on 3485, and we are adjourned.
Thank you.